Annapolis Inn. This is December 16th, 2010, and we are having our last meeting of the interim for the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. We do have quite a full agenda, but I would like to start out, if Phil, if you could help me, we do have some committee measures that we would like to introduce, so why don't we just move ahead and get that over with pretty quick, so since we have a quorum. So who would like to...
Can we have staff maybe read the list, and then I'll make the motion that the staff read?
By all means,
sure.
Fine. That way we can do it quickly.
And then you would use the script.
I just did this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me read the LCs off. They're LC 259, LC 260, LC 261, LC 262, LC 263, LC 264, LC 1555, LC 1515. LC 1516, LC 1517, LC 1518, LC 1519, LC 1529, LC 1598, and LC 1622.
Madam Chair, I move that the bills provided by staff and just be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Boquist moves that the previously listed LCs be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? There's no discussion. Is there any objection? Okay. If not, the measures will be introduced as committee bills. Okay. So we got that out of the way, have we not? Well, I want to thank all of you who got up so early today to come. I had quite the saga getting here this morning since my Prius was dead, so I actually had to drive over in quite a large truck, which is parked in the basement in a very interesting position, but there you go. So my dear friend Tina Olson's in the audience today. She told me she knows how to drive big trucks, so she's going to help me out later. So I know that the day is going to go on much better than my saga this morning, and we do have some wonderful folks here this morning. For an informational presentation from Clackamas Community College's Veterans Reintegration Program. And I'd like to have these folks come up. I think that we have Shelley Perini, Dean, Clackamas Community College, Greg Myers, the Veterans Affairs Coordinator, Stefan Moeller, Dean of Curriculum and Institutional Research. And then we have two guests, Major General retired Dan Hitchcock and Major General Kurt Loop. And these are the Reserve Ambassadors from Oregon. And we're going to start with you three folks. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Thank you for inviting us here today to tell the story of what Clackamas Community College is doing to serve our veterans and also our military family members. And for the record, again, my name is Shelley Perini. I'm the Dean of College Advancement for Clackamas Community College. But before we get into our storyboard here today and open it up to questions, I would just like to say thank you to all of you for your hard work and service in supporting our veterans and military community. It means a lot to us in Clackamas, the support you have provided us. And I want to assure you that all of the good work that you're going to hear about today wouldn't be possible without your help. And it especially is attributed to the leadership of Senator Martha Schrader, who everything you're going to hear about today, there is her leadership imprint everywhere. As probably most of you know, she helped us bring veteran services to Clackamas Community College starting in 2007 with this historic reintegration activity that we're continuing today. So we honor you and thank you. And as you listen to this, know that this is attributed to all of your hard work. So with that, Captain Myers.
Well, good morning. I'd like to, you know, just add to Shelley and thank you for the opportunity to come down here and share what we've been doing up there. And thank you, Martha. And your support has been extraordinary, outstanding, and unparalleled. So we appreciate that. My name is Greg Myers. I'm the Veterans Affairs Coordinator for Clackamas Community College. And as a former active duty Marine of 14 years and current Marine Corps reservist, I brought a unique perspective to Clackamas Community College and the development of our veteran services. As a first-generation college student from rural Oregon, I was able to jumpstart my higher education with the use of my earned educational benefits in Oregon's community college system. I learned then in the mid-90s that the community college truly is the perfect place for returning veterans to begin their education and the process of reintegration. Clackamas Community College recognized this opportunity and has established a top-down commitment to serving the 37,000 veterans of Clackamas County. With the welcome help of community partnerships like Team Clackamas, our local, state, and federal elected officials, and an unparalleled intrinsic desire to serve veterans, CCC, is rapidly emerging as a transition assistance center of excellence. About our Vet Center, over the last year, we have worked to develop our Veterans One Stop into a service center of excellence that any veteran from any era will feel comfortable to utilize for information, referral, and fellowship with other veterans. Successful transitions truly do begin at the CCC One Stop. At CCC, veteran services have grown and become integrated through extensive research and responding to feedback from our veteran students. We developed our Veterans One Stop. The One Stop concept is not new. However, it is new to CCC and is proven to be the best method to serve veterans. Most of our veteran services and staff are now conveniently located in one place, staffed by veterans for veterans. And furthermore, our educational benefits, financial aid, enrollment services, academic advising, small business development, customized training, workforce services, counseling, and disability services have been connected really through the One Stop. And all are serving veteran students and family members every day. A little testimony. Recently, a veteran student came in very distressed because he was hungry, tired, and his electricity had been shut off. I shared my lunch with him and referred him to the community resources for emergency assistance. The next morning, he came back with a big smile on his face, and we were able to talk about other more serious and personal issues, and I connected him with some free counseling services. More examples. Disabled veterans are learning how to and where to file disability claims. Hungry veterans have been fed and referred to local resources for food. Veterans and military family members in need have been referred to professional counseling services. Hundreds of unemployed veterans have been connected with workforce services. Veteran students are connecting, supporting each other, and studying together, which is one of the most important things that we offer. Hundreds of resources are on display with full-time staff to explain them, and questions are being answered and connections are being made every day. On partnerships. Through our solid partnership with the Oregon National Guard, Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Team, and Team Clackamas Community Partnership, we successfully sponsored two family reunions for the families of the 41st Brigade during the deployment. After they returned, we sponsored the Yellow Ribbon Career and Benefits Fair in June, the 60-day demobilization training and transition assistance program training. We have welcomed and connected thousands of Oregon National Guard soldiers with their family members with Oregon's educational opportunities, Oregon's veterans-friendly employers, and Oregon's outstanding and large network of veteran-oriented service providers. On the ACE Walmart Success for Veterans grant, through our grant, we have explored new ways to provide college credit for military schools and training. Currently, CCC accepts all ACE, American Council on Education, credit as college credit, saving our veterans thousands in tuition. And with the help of this grant, we are working tirelessly to take this to the next level. Our vision is to provide a seamless degree crosswalk of some of our soldiers with for some of our soldiers with the transferable training and skills required for the following degrees and certificates: project management, leadership, and business. Other disciplines under review that could potentially be utilized in the future are computer support specialists, supervisory training, medical assistant, corrections, criminal justice, human resource management, emergency management, automotive technician, and fire science, to name a few. We will build the model, share that model statewide, replicate it with more degrees and certificates, and sustain it for our veterans. It is the least that we can do for our veterans that have sacrificed so much for us. It's my pleasure to introduce you to the man that will make this happen, our Dean of Curriculum, Planning, and Research, Mr. Stephen Moore.
Good morning, Mr. Moore.
Good morning, everyone. We know that this will be an intensive and ongoing effort. Up to now, departments have been working with students as they come and show an interest in a specific academic program. The department advisor will evaluate the coursework and their experience and will award credit based on this. As a matter of fact, I would like to call your attention to a handout that's in your packet. It looks something like this, and especially the back side of it, if I may. In some instances, the description of the military occupational specialty coursework is such that it's quite apparent what credit it would match to as far as a particular program is concerned. At other times, it requires additional information related to the outcomes of the training. And finally, there are even times when it requires really an interview with the person to say, what was your experience? What were the specifics of your experience to see how it matches up? What you have in front of you here on this sheet in that chart is an example of what was done for a specific student who was interested in an AAS in automotive service technology. The department chair sat down with him and looked at the various MOS training that he had been through and matched it up with specific credits to help this person get to degree much faster. Our desire and our intent is to continue this work and make this into a much longer list of both the military occupational specialties and what are the courses that would transfer, to share this with other colleges in Oregon so that we don't have to, each time a student comes along, do the work again. So that is the that's the intent. We're starting on it. We are working with departments to make sure that they are satisfied, that the outcomes are similar, and we will continue to work with them. And where there may be gaps, actually find ways of bridging those gaps as well. So, any questions?
Yes, Senator Melissa Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Someone who has had the training in the military.
Yes.
And it's listed as one of these numbers.
Yes.
Yeah. And they come to Clackamas. Do they have to take a test, a competency test? They just accept it across the board requirement
that,
met.
That is the intent for many of these things. There may be instances where it is not that clear, and the department may say, "All right, we would like you to, do X, Y, or Z in order for us to accept it as credit." But it comes to us as a transcript, as was mentioned, from ACE, American Council on Education, and there are generally recommendations for X number of credits in this area. What they recommend is not specific to course numbers. So it may say, it says two semester hours in physical conditioning, or two semester hours in diesel engines. So it then becomes important for the college to say, what does that match up with as far as the coursework that we offer, and make that crosswork.
Well, I think it's a very innovative idea, just follow up. And are there other community colleges doing this? Are you aware of any?
I am not aware of any that are doing it to this degree. I'm sure that there are some that may be doing pieces of it, but we're hoping to actually create a fairly large, what we refer to as a crosswalk between the MOS and the coursework, and then share that with others.
Great.
Thank you, Manager. I think Clackamas Community College needs to be commended for following the law. And if you don't know under state statute already, what they presented is the American Accreditation, which is the same organization that also accredits higher institutions across the nation, these quarterly things that comes in and reviews all of our schools and so on and so forth, establishes that outline exactly as they presented. And already under state law, the community colleges have the authority to go in and take that accreditation. Of course, you absolutely have to crosswalk it, because one person's 100 level course is another one's 150 course, so on and so forth. I actually have a son that's at a different community college, and he has all of the transcripts from that are provided not via the military, but from the educational accreditation, the American accreditation, just like we're accredited. And of course, that community college doesn't want to spend the time to go through them. Yeah. And so they just he has 85 course hours from accredited at the federal level, and they're only interested of the ones that actually match exactly. They don't want to take the time to do the crosswalk. And that's an important fact, because many of the veterans benefits that we are enjoying today in the new QDR, Quadrangle Defense Review, are going to go away in the next 2 to 3 years. And so the ability to take what they've already been educated at, plug it in our local community colleges at that level, and then give them the accreditations they need in the civilian side to get a well-paying, family-sustaining job is absolutely critical. I mean, Clackamas Community College is on the cutting edge. It's where all of our community colleges need to be.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Yeah.
I know that at Mount Hood Community College, which is in my district, they have a huge automotive curriculum. And I am going to talk with Dr. Ski and say, look at what Clackamas County Community College or Clackamas Community College is doing. So I commend you. Thank you very much.
And we'd love to share this information.
Sure.
The whole idea is to be able to share it with Mount Hood Community.
Because it's not reinventing the wheel, because you're doing all the major work. And then that can just be transferred to the others, yeah.
And if I understand, you have a Walmart grant that moved us forward, and I think the whole intent is to take your innovations, and all of you have been so kind to me. I have to tell you, it's really all of your work I've just kind of been a little bit of a cheerleader in the background, but Shelley, you've done it, Greg, you've done it, you've all pulled this together in a way that's going to inform. I'd like to hope, as we hand this off to my colleagues during the next session, that it'll inform how the whole community college system works. And that was the intent of the grant, as I understood it, is to innovate it, figure it out, get the model pulled together, and then with your work colleagues, let's go ahead and get the community college folks in here and show them how we do it better.
So with that, and I would just like to say, just as a caveat, to begin the model, there's still a lot more hard work that needs to be done. What we've been able to seed with the ACE Walmart grant is the beginning of the development of the model. So hopefully we'll continue raising some resources to allow us to continue that journey. But that's reported in your packet, some of the key programs that we're looking at investing in out of the gate, like automotive.
So when you say the seed...
Yes.
In terms of the model, what kind of a timeline do you see in terms of having a model actually
by spring? By spring of 2011, we will have the first foundation and the first three crossovers for degrees identified and in place and ready to transfer to Mount Hood Community College or any other community college in Oregon, along with other specialty certificate and courses. So I just don't want to leave the perception that we are going to be able to have a crosswalk for every career pathway that exists right now, but we certainly will have identified the major, three major area of opportunities to begin the journey. And then we've applied for some other grant and appropriation resources to continue the hard work. But we will have a first foundation ready to share by spring of 2011.
So, Chair?
Yes.
How do you know how many veterans are in your county? I mean, do they have a census? Is there a way for a college to see how many veterans are in your locality?
Well, the 37,000 comes from the county's our socio-demographic reports.
Mm-hmm. There's a socio-demographic.
Yeah, so from our census reports.
Mm-hmm. So, well, thank you.
Okay. Well, so next on our presentation today, we actually had some wonderful news that we thought you would appreciate hearing. Also, thanks to the leadership of Senator Schrader and two wonderful heroes who are about ready to come up to the podium. They are two assets that we are very blessed to have here in Oregon. They are the Oregon Army Reserve Ambassadors, and I would like to ask them to come to the podium, Major General Dan Hitchcock and Major General Kurt Loop, to tell you about a new Oregon asset that's going to be housed at Clackamas Community College. So, yes, no, we're going to have them come here. We'll bring you back up.
That's what happens when your captain, Major General, throw you out. I'm familiar with that.
Senator Boquist is going to take over this next go-around, he promised me. I'm putting you on the spot and on the record. So he's going to be the go-to guy with Senator Monis Anderson here. And what level are you?
Not high enough.
Not high enough? Oh, I'm sorry. So
I made too many enemies like them.
Oh, you did? Okay. Well,
but not them. They're great gentlemen. They're great active gentlemen. Duty officers that I managed to irritate.
Yes.
Good morning. We're going to tell you something.
And for the record, we need to have you identify yourselves.
My name is Kurt Loop.
Okay, and?
And I'm Dan Hitchcock.
Okay.
From Canby, Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here today, gentlemen. You've been great, great friends.
And I'm going to take you back a little bit. In about 2007, Clackamas Community College had a job and benefit fair put on, and with the help of then County Commissioner Schrader. And that was Dan and my first opportunity to visit that and see what it was all about. And we were so impressed. We have been an advocate and a sponsor of that event for many years now. About the same time, Laura Stoltz, the wife of Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz, the Chief of Army Reserve, had the idea. We've had so many deployments of the Army Reservists that they didn't have the same benefits that somebody that would deploy for a regular Army from an installation had. And so she came up with an idea of a virtual installation, and she has started that, put the bug in the General's ear. And so he funded the first one back east. And what this is an Army Strong Community Center. And this is a place that somebody, a family, a soldier, a veteran, or a veteran's family can go to get resources that are available to any military person on an installation. And so it gave them somebody face-to-face they could talk with and put their arms around an issue and walk it through. And so they opened three of these on the East Coast, one in New York, one in Pennsylvania, one in South Carolina. Through a fortuitous alignment of the stars and our sponsorship and talking with General Stoltz back east, they wanted an Army Strong Community Center put on the West Coast. And Oregon was selected as the place to put that. And through General Hitchcock's effort, he wanted to site it, and we supported the siting of it at the Clackamas Community College. Clackamas Community College has a very proactive and aggressive outreach effort to the veterans and their families, and that it was a marriage to begin with. So they are going to put a Army Strong Community Center in a Clackamas Community College. And some of the resources and referrals that they'll be able to get at that site are health benefits with TRICARE. Some of the people who is going to, you know, which doctors take TRICARE, health insurance, health, all the myriad of health care and dental issues, VA benefits for the veterans' families, what are you eligible for, how do you get them, how do you work your way through the maze, that sort of thing. Succeeding as a military families, the financial brochures that help them budget. The younger people need to know how to budget, how to avoid the pitfalls of going into debt. A lot of the community resources, who's offering certain resources to veterans, to the families, how can you take advantage of that? So they're going to become a hub of resources, benefits, and services to the thing. There'll also be computers there that the veterans can go into and access into the military networks. In your packet, you've got a brochure that goes into more detail on this, but you can see, if you'll open it up to the first, inside the first page, you'll see that Clackamas has been identified. This is a brochure from the Association of the United States Army, who is supporting this as well. They heard about this. They wanted to get behind it. And so our association, president by General Gordon Sullivan, who was the prior chief of staff of the Army, is behind this as well. So it's going to be an outstanding resource. It does have a label, Army Strong Community Service, but it is not restricted to the Army or the Army Reserve or the active Army. It is open to all veterans, all services, that people can come in. It is supposed to be an installation, a military installation. So a lot of that stems back from, like I said, the seed was planted with Senator Schrader and her support of the job and benefit fair that Clackamas Community College had. and this is what it's going to be. Last week, a team came in, did the interviews with two people to be hired to staff the office. Clackamas Community College has given us the room, the facilities, right there in the center of campus. We're going to put two people in there probably by the end of the month. And then there'll be a grand opening in the spring. But they'll be on board the first of the year providing services and getting their network established. In the interest of brevity, I'll be quiet unless there are any questions.
Any questions, comments?
No.
Go ahead.
No, I just get excited about the innovation that you're providing. And I'm very sorry to lose Senator Schrader in the next go-around, but she has been a true champion of this, and I'm so glad that it started in Clackamas County. It's great.
Well,
let me add one thing. You had a question what other community colleges were doing the MOS crosswalk to education. Commissioner Diane McKeel from Multnomah County heard something going on, so she has come over, and Dean Perini has set up a meeting. She's gotten a wind of this. She asked, could they set up a kind of a mirror office over at Portland State University? And
great.
So I went over and briefed them for an hour, and they said, well, we'll just do it. And I said, no, you need somebody that's going to champion. You need a faculty member that's going to champion this cause, because the students are going to go. Every 4 years they should be gone, 5 years now. Unless it's a real tough degree and they'll be around 8 years, I don't know. But you need a faculty to champion this cause and to make the standards be met, especially for the MOS and the accreditation of things that you get in the military to be accepted by a university.
I have a question.
Yes, sure.
I actually have a graybeard question for you. Have either of you gentlemen had the opportunity to read the legislative portion and the reserve portion of the recent quadrangle defense review?
No, sir.
Which probably means you haven't seen General Reimer's reserve component review that's not out, that's in, I guess we could say, limited circulation because it hasn't been released totally yet. You haven't seen that either?
No, sir.
Okay. I would encourage you to, I'm sure Bill Taylor has your contacts, because
yeah.
I would be most interested in seeing your reaction to the QDR and to General Reimer's report.
Why?
We're going back to the cycle we're already in, that we've been in before. They're throwing the RC component completely under the bus, all the way across the board, going down to 39 IDTs. Doing away with annual training. IDTs are individual training units.
Thank you.
And if you look at the U.S. Senate Committee on Appropriations release that just came out for the full consolidation funding bill or the continuing resolution for the whole year, it's taken another hit at the reserve components and specifically, you know, veterans and everything else along that line. So. Without graybeards, if you don't, so you ladies know, graybeards are all the retired generals.
Okay.
Who have more weight than anybody else in the Defense Department, because collectively they can beat the daylights behind scenes out of all of their former peers. And so, and as you've experienced right here, when they get activated and they go after something, they generally get their way, which, you know, is great for the state of Oregon. But there are some disconcerting things that we're going right back into the old cycles. The war is coming to an end, and the first thing you cut is reserve components.
Yeah.
So, but as soon as we get our hands on the final copies of them,
I'd like to see that.
You can get it, because I think you would.
What we hear are two different things. We hear one thing, and now you're
okay.
What's in writing?
Yeah, we know how that works, sir.
Yes, sir.
So we will make sure that you get the documentation, and like I said, I'm obviously leaving this committee in great hands. And by the way, there will be a Senate Veterans Committee next go-around. The Senate President has told me, because I asked, I said, you're not going to let any of this drop, and I know that, Senator Boquist, you're going to chair it, I hope.
That's the theory.
We need you.
No, I'm going to guilt you into this. You're not, you know.
Well, Madam Chair, I committed, you know, right after your phone call and made all the stuff that, you know, I would help the majority, whoever it was, ensure that all of these LCs and everything that we have done to date doesn't become forgotten, and that we actually move forward with the reintegration and all the recommendations of the task force. And with a member of the majority on the committee, I'm sure we can manage to get those that are reasonable through the system.
You know, Madam Chair, I so want bipartisanship.
Absolutely.
The public wants bipartisanship, and I'm excited.
And this is one of the, and I've constantly said, the pillar community in both the House and the Senate is the Veterans Committees, which has been a total bipartisan support in the last three sessions of veterans and the military.
And I have to say, I think it's so wise, because we need some, things are so contentious still. People are so worried, out of work, having such a difficult time. To have issues in what you folks are doing as the great unifiers of the state is really what is essential that we continue to happen. I'm just so astounded that that you're doing this. We're the first on the West Coast.
Yes, ma'am.
First on the West Coast. And I think I remember kind of serendipity. Somebody had gone to Congressman Schrader's office. It was one of the folks from the East Coast, and I called the president of Community College, Joanne Truesdale, up and said, you know, I think there's somebody here from the Army you guys need to talk to. And, of course, we have you two wonderful gentlemen and friends who have been great champions of this. This is remarkable, and I would really like to see this get it out there. I mean, we need to own this. I mean, Oregon needs to own this in a way that we've never owned it before. Mm-hmm. And the one good thing about me not being here, I will be, you know, on the East Coast a little more frequently, and I'm already starting to organize the spouses a little bit around these issues. So, Senator Boquist and Senator Moses Anderson, if you keep it going here and I get my pipeline to you, we'll get our pipeline going on the East Coast to continue to get some legislation and to keep the passion going there at a different level. So.
And I wanted to mention, too, that on our first meeting concerning the Army Strong Community Center here in Oregon, our team from the Pentagon came out, and they were going to do a search of facilities, and they had put together a list of different places to look around the Portland area and around in Salem. And we held a meeting in Oregon City in Senator Congressman Schrader's office.
Yeah.
And Senator Schrader attended, and so they talked about the different facilities, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, came this suggestion for Clackamas Community College to be an ideal location. And so we took the team up there. They met with President Truesdale and with Shelley Perini. And before they left, they were pretty well sold that this is the spot on the Northwest to open the first Army Strong Community Center. So appreciate your encouragement at that point and your insistence that they look at Clackamas Community College. Also like to thank you for your support and help on the community covenants.
Thank you.
Clackamas County has had more community covenants than any place else in the state of Oregon.
What is a community covenant?
It's another program that the Department of Army came out with about 2 years ago to build awareness in different communities of our Guard and Reserve and military members that are serving and deployed, and then the families that are still residing within the communities that most of the people, including their neighbors, are not even aware that they're there because we're not part of a military installation. And so the process was to work with community leaders and put together a covenant where we had commitment from key leaders and businesses and political leaders in those communities, and we'd have a public signing and have a ceremony, and we started out. The first one in Oregon was here in Salem with the governor, and then the next one was with Clackamas Community College put on the next one, and then Clackamas County held a special session where they brought in, invited all the communities and all the mayors from all the cities in Clackamas County to come in and sign the covenant that had been started by Clackamas Community College. The city of Mooloolah held a signing, and the city of Canby held a separate signing during the county fair last year. So we've had,
and it focuses on their commitment
to
meeting the needs
to soldiers, the families, veterans. Yeah.
Of all branches. Even though it came
from, it came out of the Army, and it can be either Army restrictive or they'll open it up to all the services, all seven services.
And I believe, Diane, Commissioner McKeel is leading that effort.
She is looking in to try to get one into the Multnomah County area. Wonderful. And Senator Schrader was signed the first one in Clackamas community.
Wonderful.
And appreciate your help.
Well, and
I
wanted to thank you for Canby too, because it was very important that our own hometown actually move ahead with that. It's symbolic largely, but it really raises that level of awareness, which is, I think, is the key fundamental step that people need to take, to be aware that, you know, just that they know that it's there. Again, it's a real community builder. Actually, doing that.
I did want to mention just inside of your folders that you have, you'll find a little flyer on the employer partnership. Employer partnership was another program that came from the Army Reserve and is now a Department of Defense program, where employers are contacted and they explain the needs that they have in their employees, and the Army tries to make a match with the training and experience that we have in the Army Reserve and the National Guard and the other reserves, and then build that relationship. And there's a website where employers can go in and find people that have these skills, and also the military members can go into this website and find employers that are looking for the specific skills they have. And you have the brochure there, and we'll be offering that throughout the state of Oregon as part of the National Guard's program for Fort Oregon. And I guess in closing, I would just to say how much I appreciate your effort, your commitment, and your sincere appreciation of military members and their families. It's been significant, and I thank you for that.
So, Senator Schrader, you asked us to provide a gift to the committee in our closing remarks. So I would like to ask Greg to come back up to the podium. In your packet, speaking of supporting family members, Clackamas Community College, along with many members from the great state of Oregon, have helped develop an endowment, which is open to any veteran family member from our great state. And it's actually, when we asked our veterans, what can we do to help you in terms of education and training, they said, help our families. So we started the Military Family Scholarship Endowment. We've raised about $250,000 to date, and we are giving out an average of 2 scholarships a year. We had our last big fundraiser on October 21st, and to celebrate that, a wonderful poet from New York named Fran Ritchie, on her own time and as a gift to the Oregon National Guard and to this endowment, created this beautiful book of poetry. We had asked her if she would be so kind to perhaps recommend a poem for us, but then perhaps we were took it one step forward to maybe write a poem, and she said, I don't even know what a National Guard is. What do they do? Her son's a Marine, but she didn't know what a National Guard was. And so we set her up with a series of interviews from members of our own Oregon National Guard, and she fell so in love with their stories that instead of writing a poem, she wrote a book of poetry. And so I would just like to share this with you, because if you have the time to read these, I encourage you to do so, because every word is theirs. She actually started this effort twice in a very rapid manner. Every word in here is theirs. What she did from a poetic stance is she took out sort of the clutter of the conversation, and every word is authentic to their journey. So I just wanted to preface that, and the gift is you have a general and a captain who are actually going to read two of the poems to you and the books. So with that, Captain Myers.
Grace. Everything went white. And then we were flying through the air, I know. But someone grabbed onto me and I felt really secure. When I was flying through the air, it was like there was a lady that grabbed me. I don't know who she was. She just whispered my name in my ear. And then I remember hitting the ground on my back. It was like getting sucker punched. It was burning me. I haven't told many people this. Some people might go, oh yeah, whatever. You just got your bell rung. The lady, she grabbed me from behind. I don't know how to explain this, but when she talked, I could see her. I'd seen her before, but I'd never seen her. I think she had light hair. There's an aura when somebody dies. They're still there for a while. I've seen that. Honestly, I think she's always been around me. It was like, oh yeah, I remember that voice. It was a sweet, nice voice. She held on to me tight. And when I hit the ground, that was it. She was gone.
This is combat. He was killed instantly by a large IED that ripped one of our vehicles apart. Literally. There were five individuals. Two were killed. They were local interpreters. Bruno was the third. The other two I was able to pull out, and they made it. But you mentioned if there was a time or an image. When I came up on the vehicle, and Bruno was laying in the vehicle, and his eyes were wide open. He's got bright blue eyes. It sticks with you. Bruno himself was the type of guy that lived life. He was easily persuasive, vibrant in life itself. That image of his eyes, I kind of wish I could forget. They were fixed to me when I came up, and you could see it in there. I felt it was like, help me. And we tried, but we weren't able to bring him back.
Waiting. When he's gone, I can't sleep in our bed. For most of the year, I slept in the living room in the recliner. And my husband knows. He knows I'm like that. So he calls and talks to my son and says, where's your mom sleeping? Tell her to sleep in her own room, for crying out loud. I have his cologne that he always wore, and I would spray it wherever. For the kids, instead of having pillowcases on their beds, we used his T-shirts. And we made a flat daddy, and we took him to the Enchanted Forest. Flat Daddy went on all the rides with us. He went to the first day of school. Our song is John Denver's Annie song. That song, it was his ringtone on my cell. I knew I wasn't going to hear that ringtone forever. My kids know every word to it. For them, that is Mom and Dad's song. That is the song is Dad. There's a tree outside. It's just an ugly old cherry tree, but they called it the Daddy Tree. So they would pick leaves off the Daddy Tree. They were Daddy leaves. If someone would leave somewhere when there were leaves on it, they would pick them off and take them with us in the car. Anywhere. You know, that was their thing. The worst time is really not a specific time, but you know, sometimes when you haven't heard from him in a couple days, maybe, and you hear a car door shut outside. There's been a couple days like that where you just kind of think, oh my God, please. You know? After you put the kids to bed, that's when the lonely sets in. Because the kids keep you busy all day, and after they're in bed, it gets quiet. There are a lot of nights spent with the same song, Wait for You. It just makes you cry when you listen to it. But you can't help but listen to it over and over. So thank you. Thank you, Senator Schrader, for all your work.
And I was afraid I wouldn't get through this without tissues. So thank you, Bill, for making sure you have tissues. Okay, thank you, Noah, for that. And thank you. A few words about this book is I had an opportunity to meet with Frances. And she is a lovely woman, and I think this is probably one of the first books of this kind, and it was commissioned by Clackamas Community College, that is really pulling together the voices of people in a way that I don't think has been done before, at least during this cycle of war that we've been experiencing. So I know that Frances has ownership of this. The college, again, with Shelley Perini and our friends, were essential in making that connection with her and actually bringing her out to Oregon. And I think that there are bigger and better... I think that this is going to... be a bigger piece than we realize right now, because the voices are so beautiful and so authentic. So, colleagues, really keep this. This is a very unique publication, and once again, I think that Oregon's leading the way. So, and thank you for being here. I just so appreciate the support and the friendship. So, well, with that, Bill, I was going to ask you, we are have this room for another hour. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, we have it until noontime.
We have it until noon. Yeah. Well, we won't go to noon, folks, but I just wanted to make sure that I move into chair mode and make sure that we're using our time. But thank you for coming. You really made my day today in a way that I can barely even tell you how much I appreciate it. So let's see who's on the agenda. We did have... invited testimony from the Invisible Wounds of War, Judy Cushing, David Diedrichson, and Deborah Zweibachen. Did they come this morning? Evidently not. I don't think we have a presentation here.
I spoke to them.
Well, it's fine. No worries. Then we'll move on to the review of veterans issues with Dr. Colleen Louie and Eddie Black. And this is from OHSU. And we'll be talking about domestic violence and PTSD. So if you folks would mind coming up and introducing yourselves, and we'll move on through the agenda. No. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. As you're setting up, the generals are leaving, and I'll give them a hug next time I see them, hopefully sooner than later. But thanks for coming today.
That's not a PowerPoint, though.
That one, right?
The Veterans Task Force presentation.
While we're waiting, I'm reading some of these poems, and they just sear my heart. Like one, it says, "For a week or two, I knew I was going to die. I wanted to make everything straight, as straight as I could. I wanted to be a brave person, be what people would expect of me. I've always respected people. Who even though they know something's bad's going to happen, they go anyway." And then it goes on and on about how it's not like you give up or anything, but it's like, hey, this feeling in your head when you die, when you think you're going to die, you better get things straight. And the last sentence is, "I don't know why I lived." I mean, some of those things, I mean, they just grab your heart.
And it was hours and hours of interviews with these guards, men and women, really, to pull this together. And this woman is probably, next to Shelley, one of the greatest souls in my friend Tina I've ever met. And I really think this needs to go to Ashland. I think they need to put it on stage. It's just me thinking off the top of my head. I think that it's a beautiful document.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful document. But welcome. How about I have you folks introduce yourselves, and thanks for being here today. And we'll move on with the next section of our agenda this morning. So,
all right. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for having us here today. Thank you for your time. My name is Eddie Black, and I just happened to the computer. I didn't touch anything, I swear.
It's okay. It's going into hibernation.
Okay.
No
worries.
I work with various entities, one of which is with OHSU, as remarked earlier with Dr. Louie here, and I also work with the Cadre program out of Oregon City, which I'll get into, and I also did some paid work, and I do some part-time work for the Oregon National Guard Reintegration Team as well. And so that's me.
Okay, Dr. Louie.
Madam Chairman, thank you again for having us. My name is Colleen Louie. Thank you to members of the committee as well. We're very both excited about being here today to give you our presentations, and we're going to start with Eddie, and then we'll move into the stuff that we're doing at OHSU.
Okay. Great. Technical difficulties, but we'll work them out here.
That generally happens when I ask for call for fire. The absolute worst time.
I know.
I've had that experience before, too. Where's our air support? Oh, they're over there.
But see, that's why I didn't make it to that rank of general, because, you know, when I asked for it and it didn't come, he didn't like what I told him.
We got a general in the back. We still have one left, General Paul.
See, that general knows the general I'm talking about.
Oh, really? So okay.
He probably has the same opinion I do.
We won't name names, though, right?
Yeah, okay. And you're not from the state of Oregon, so let's be fair.
Okay, good.
Well, the material that I'm going to start off with is particularly scary. It's actually very alarming. The Cadre program, Combat and Domestic Readjustment Education program. There's a website, cadreprogram.org. All this material is online. You can go online and download any and all of this stuff. And the first one is domestic violence, just a definition of domestic violence. Everybody thinks they know what domestic violence is, and that's just putting your hands on somebody, but there's a lot more to domestic violence. You can actually be arrested and charged for domestic violence for tickling somebody. And once you get that done on your record, you can get the Lautenberg Amendment, and then you can't handle a weapon, and then you're kicked out of the military, and then your life just spirals down. All kinds of problems with domestic violence. But there's a lot of controlling behaviors in domestic violence. And controlling behaviors themselves are something that comes natural for the military. It's something that we are expected to do, is control. This is one of the concepts that we use. It's called the soldier box. These attitudes and beliefs and behaviors in this box are what many of us consider to be the right way to be, the right way to act. So if you throw me into a chaotic situation, I will take charge of that situation. I did not say in my introduction, but I am prior Marine Corps Desert Storm, and I'm also current National Guard Operation Iraqi Freedom 2. With some of these things here, it is very easy for some of these attitudes and beliefs to go into controlling and abusive behaviors. You take somebody that's yelling and screaming at you, it is an absolutely normal reaction for many military people to just simply choke you out to calm you down. And that is control and abuse. And that could, you know, now you're looking at an arrest, and you're looking at somebody, people's lives being changed. And so there's not even getting into the psychological changes that occur through training and experience in war. So looking at those psychological changes, 2003, New England Journal of Medicine, they looked at just psychological symptoms, whether it was jittery nerves, hypervigilance, startle response, trouble sleeping, trouble concentrating, just a whole gamut of things. It's called the PDAHRA, Post-Deployment Health Reassessment Questionnaire, and everybody in the military takes it. And this is 2003. And the National Guard that they tested, 49% of those showed some sort of symptom. I'm not saying these are PTSD or just full-blown whatever. I'm saying just psychological symptoms, just right off the bat. So another study looked at those individuals that had various symptoms that were having some sort of negative impact on their lives. Most of the military do not go to seek help. There's a lot of attention that's being placed out there to trying to get our veterans help, and there's a lot of resources out there, whether it's individuals at Clackamas Community College and others that are giving of their time for therapy, for just anything. But you can take a horse to water, and you can't make that horse drink. And this is extremely typified by how veterans are And we just lost the computer. This is typified by veterans in our just across the board, all the help that is out there.
We can also follow.
I don't have a copy myself. I was using the computer.
Here we go. We'll get you one.
Semper Gumby. Always flexible.
Indecision is the key to flexibility.
Same one. This is two copies
of the same. So what in that particular study, what they were finding was that roughly over 64% of the veterans in this particular study were not seeking help because of various regions of stigma for that is going to harm their career. It's going to have all kinds of negative repercussions. And think about it for a second. This is an individual who you're expecting to be the go-to person, and now you want this go-to person to come up and say, "Hey, I need some help." That's not how it works. That's not how I work. That's one of my own issues, is asking for help. So there's that issue. But what they also noticed is that was these psychological symptoms that are prevalent, and the fact that most veterans, male and female, are not going to get help. Or so the only reason they do go get help is they're dragged kicking and screaming by wives or husbands who are threatening to divorce them, or their court ordered, or their first sergeant, who I've been in a room with first sergeant for, who have given their soldiers orders to go to a counselor, lawful orders. That's usually the only way you get individuals to go get some sort of therapy. Now on page 6, there's the PTSD depression comparison. Now this right here is some couples that went into to get some sort of therapy, and they were going in for 4 different reasons or so: anger management, relationship problems, or something of that effect. And they split them up into 3 groups. The veteran had PTSD, the veteran had depression, but not PTSD, or the veteran did not have either. Because there's a lot of information work out there about PTSD is the thing. Well, what they found was that PTSD or depression, there wasn't any difference as far as the violence that was being perpetuated. What is particularly scary about this study is that the couples that went in for treatment in this study, if they had any substance abuse issues, they were not allowed into the study. And one of the patterns that you can find anywhere, veteran or not veteran, is that there's substance abuse, there violence usually goes along beside it. And so that we have these high rates of violence by the veteran without substance abuse is particularly alarming. And severe violent acts, the dark parts of the bars are the severe violent acts. We're military, we're trained. We get in a fight, we're not here to tickle you. We know what to do. In other studies cite that one of the veterans tend to withdraw a lot because we know what we're capable of, so we just won't even go there. We'll just withdraw from everybody, family, work, because we're scared of what we're capable of. On page 7, they compared veterans with non-veterans of their same age. They went to college campuses and other civilian areas looking at couples going into therapy, and they just wanted to compare veterans to non-veterans of the same age groups, and they found that the veterans were 6 times more likely to perpetuate just violence, physical violence, and they were 14 times more likely than the non-veterans to perpetuate severe violence, leaving bruises, breaking bones, and choking people out. And again, when you say to the average person, choking somebody out, oh, that's absolutely horrible, I don't know how many times it's crossed my mind when I've been in a room with somebody who is particularly annoying, it would be so easy just to choke you out, lay you up against the wall, and you wake up in a couple minutes, then we can go from there. It is a quick, fast reaction. I train infantry for the National Guard. I train people to react fast, decisively, and overwhelmingly. We do not have time to talk to you in a combat situation. I need to kill the target, move on. On page 4, it's particularly alarming because there is no screening for psychopathology. They don't screen out the veterans because...
What page?
8. Page 8. I do apologize. There's no screening for psychopathology. They did not separate the veteran because of PTSD, depression, substance abuse, or anything. They just said all veterans, all military. and they looked at the rates of interpersonal violence there compared to the U.S. And for the U.S., it was 12% of the population, whereas the military was 36%. Again, this is not very counterintuitive. You take two people, one civilian, one veteran, put them into a bar and have somebody go up to each one and insult them. Do you really see that veteran going, oh yeah, you're right, let me go walk away? Or do you see that person getting into your John Wayne bar fight? We have a lot of imagery to uphold. I don't know how many Marine Corps sergeants, when I went up to them after being arrested and they asked me, why'd you do it? They insulted the honor of the Marine Corps sergeant. Well, okay, that's a good reason. Carry on.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
What about traumatic brain injury? Is that separated out as well?
They did not separate for anything. For traumatic brain injury, that is actually one of the... I haven't come across anything that studied that connected to domestic violence. However, with TBI, the signs and symptoms of TBI are... There's a lot of overlap between PTSD and TBI. Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the... I'm sorry.
But not necessarily... Well, okay. The person has the kind of training that you describe to start with. So if there's traumatic brain injury, that may or may not exacerbate the problem, right?
It's quite likely that it will.
Yeah.
It's quite likely that it will. Roger.
Okay.
The study, within the population of the on page 8, there are people with TBI in this population. This is everybody in the military. And the signs and symptoms of people with TBI are, there's a lot of overlap between PTSD, hypervigilance, over-aggressiveness, anger, hostility. And the differences between aggression and hostility. Aggression is a physical act, whereas hostility is a sort of a viewpoint of the world. Everybody is out to get you, sort of thing. I have negative beliefs about everybody. On page 9, it was a study with Vietnam veterans that came into a clinic seeking help, any kind of help. And all they did was separate these Vietnam veterans who came in for any kind of help into two groups, PTSD and non-PTSD. And then they asked them about doing physical violent acts in the past year, the past 12 months. That group with PTSD, or so 75% of the veterans with PTSD had perpetuated physical violence against somebody else within the past 12 months. The group without PTSD, only 17%. The average number of violent acts in the PTSD group was 22 per person. That's huge. So again, what I was saying earlier is like everybody, there's a lot of attention about PTSD. Well, on page 10, there's the necessary requirements to be to have a clinical diagnosis of PTSD, but what if you don't have all of that? I know nearly everybody that I know who's come back has some symptoms of PTSD, hypervigilance, defensive or aggressive driving rather, high irritability with, coffee baristas at long lines and all kinds of stuff, trouble sleeping, jumpiness at backfired cars. Not full-blown PTSD. Well, they found that looking at the acts of aggression within the past 4 months, there was no difference between full-blown PTSD and subclinical. Just a couple of the symptoms. The biggest difference between those who had no symptoms. There's a big difference there. So that was, you don't have to have PTSD to have these violent reactions. So on page 11 are just some of the collections of factors that help predict interpersonal violence. Younger age, we find that as age increases, the tendency for interpersonal violence decreases. We also find that the ability to work with the individual on a cognitive behavioral approach tends to decrease as well. They're more set in their ways, whereas the younger individuals who are more likely to perpetuate the violence are more open to change. Lower rank, socioeconomic...
Question?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When these studies, I know that men tend to be much more aggressive than women, or at least maybe women are more subtle in their aggression than men, but is this primarily men? And I'm just wondering what women veterans, if they are showing the same violence that that men do because of the training. Have you looked at that at all?
There's not much, Senator, there's not much about women in general on domestic violence. Most of the attention is given toward men, as most domestic violence is perpetuated by men in the field. But what I will say is that within the military is predominantly a masculine culture. Mm-hmm. And the women in the military must also pick up the attitudes and behaviors of masculine schemas. And they must operate as such. I don't have any studies that look at that directly.
Okay.
That is one of the areas that our program would like to go into first. However, our first priority is male batterers, as that is, by and large, the majority of cases that we see. But on something similar to that, we do notice that male veterans with PTSD are abused by their wives 6 times more likely than male veterans without PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the speculation of that is because PTSD, the social, the withdrawal and the withdrawal of emotion, the speculation is that, well, I got to get some sort of reaction out of you just to see if you're alive. But that's, mm-hmm. again, we don't know.
I always say this, but I would hope that the military will take a look at women's issues too, because they are growing exponentially as a part of the force, and that includes, I was on the women's task force for veterans women's health this past year, and I was just made aware of so many issues, and there are going to be a number of recommendations coming to this committee from that group, but I just want to put on the record that there's a horrendous amount of rape and sexual abuse and battering going on between men and women within the military too, and we have, because of the way the training is, I mean, I take a look at the things that you said, I've got to say some of them. I think that's up there here, yeah. Don't question orders. Suspect everyone. Don't care. With us or against us. Know your exits. Never show weakness. Kill or be killed. Never flinch. Relax or you die. I mean, these are things that are part of the training process, correct? So that, because if you flinch, you die. I mean, that's why I just find this so overwhelming on how you can separate what you're being trained to do when you're in combat and then your personal life, and that's what's just so horrendous to me, and because I think it's very difficult to separate those things out when you're especially in combat.
Roger.
Yeah,
Roger. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
The factors, substance abuse, all of these go into the likelihood of violence. One of the things I did not mention at the was I asked for numbers on veterans in the state, and the closest that I can come to is that National Guard wise, we're looking around 9,000 or just shy of 9,000 people. That includes the Air and the Army National Guard, and statewide, the Oregon, the governor's task force on veteran services, it's like 350,000. I just recently got some numbers that were 340,000-something. But if you look at just the, if 36% of the military and veteran, this one study, cite interpersonal violence, and you look at, we have 350,000 veterans in the state, that's, I'm expecting, good gosh,
a lot.
Just looking at 9,000 Oregon National Guard currently in our staff right now, looking at 3,240 interpersonal violent acts is what I'm expecting.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
What about the Navy and the Air Force?
Don't have numbers on those in the state. I know from my experience working with the Oregon National Guard reintegration team, trying to, when I show up to Marine Corps units, they're overwhelmed to see me, but cross-connection between each branch with each other is very difficult to do.
But if they spend their time, okay, the Navy, if they're on a ship or so on and so forth, they're not in combat zone, so they're not very high in these incidents, I would imagine.
Likely not. Likely it's not being tracked, Roger.
Yeah.
I know a lot of fights in the Marine Corps, how you handle things in the Marine Corps,
well,
you take
Marine
two people
Corps,
in, put them in the car, and tell
combat.
Them to work it out.
They're the Marine Corps. That's not part of the Navy, though, right?
Technically, it is, Roger.
We're the fighting part of the Navy. I mean,
I wouldn't say that to the Secretary of the Navy.
Can't help it, Senator. Sorry.
To Senator Morissette's question, I think like 1.69, just under 2% of all deployed forces in the combat zone are Navy. So, I mean, there's very, very small. Now, of course, you have Navy pilots that are involved for it. You know, you have Navy corpsmen, which are Navy personnel but are part of the Marine Corps units, which, you know, have the same exact problems, which he's outlining right now. And then the Air Force slice actually on the ground forward is larger than the Navy slice, but not very much larger, just by a force structure on the ground.
However, that study did look at everybody, Navy and Air Force included. So I guess I conclude our recommendations for the cadre program, aside from, like everybody else, we would like to be fully funded, but
tell that to the federal government.
But our first recommendation, other than that, is some sort of screening. There's a lot of tools that are out there, and right now, the National Guard units in the comeback, there's 30, 60, 90-day Yellow Ribbon programs that are going on. And I know from personal experience, all of the things that we've handed to them to say, here are the tools that are for you, the optional ones are never taken. The only ones that are ever taken are the ones that are mandatory. Nobody ever takes the life-building, life-skills-building optional ones. So it is our recommendation that things of this nature be made mandatory. The second recommendation is outreach to military families, spouses, and family programs. If you had $1 to spend on veterans in this state, you will get more bang for your buck if you put it in the family programs. You take a healthy, happy individual and put him in an unhappy family, it's not going to last for long. And put an individual that's got some issues and put him with a caring and supported, loving family, and that's the best thing you can do for that individual, is that social connection. Our third recommendation is outreach to military units. Right now, first sergeants and commanding officers have no idea what to do or who to call when a soldier is arrested for domestic violence, and this is play it by ear, and then phone tag happens. So decision trees about what to do, and that's going to take some work with JAG, various units, and things of that nature. And our last recommendation is, right now, nobody's tracking with domestic violence or arrest veteran status. You can't get these numbers, so it's pure speculation. So when I say I expect 3,000 plus interpersonal violence numbers, I have no way of checking that, because nobody says, are you a veteran in domestic violence? So that's our last recommendation.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
What about the driver's license identification as a veteran? Did that kick in yet?
I believe it has. I think Mr. Taylor, remember we did the bill on veterans having a tag on licenses if someone...
So if a veteran is stopped by a highway patrolman, the highway patrolman can take a look at that and think, how do I deal with this guy?
Actually, we do have someone from...
Jim Willis.
Mr. Willis, maybe you could help us and your...
We're back at square one, though, and that's self-identified. And as he pointed out, most veterans won't self-identify.
I know, but it hasn't been implemented. I'm just wondering.
Well, if it's on their license, whether they like it or not.
No, it's not. It's self-identified.
It's self-identification.
Yeah. It's optional. They can choose
not to. But maybe you can tell us the status.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. That is going to go into place this next month.
Okay.
And it is optional. The veteran needs to self-identify, provide information indicating they are an honorably discharged veteran as a military services. And then the way it shows up on the license, there's been some confusion about that. People thought it would have a V designation or whatever. It's actually the word veteran spelled out on the face of the license. So it's very identifiable. And we're doing a campaign right now to publicize that as a service. And you may remember, Madam Chair, and other members of the committee, that in our testimony about this bill, when it was up for passage in the last session, one of the main reasons for this was that not everybody's retired from the military, so they don't have a retired ID card. Not everybody has a disability, so they don't have a VA card. So how do they show that they're an honorably discharged veteran? And how can they be identified in a situation where that is going to be helpful, which is some of what you're talking about here this morning? Well, that license will do it. Also, they can do it on the Oregon Identification Card. If they can't get a driver's license for whatever reason, you're familiar with the Oregon ID Card, which is also issued by DMV. They can get the designation on that as well.
Does that help, Senator
Morissette? Yeah. But there's a reluctance to self-identify. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is not an easy problem to solve, and it's one of the things the reintegration folks have been working on for months, because numbers that we need.
We saw this especially during the Vietnam War. I mean, I had my cousins. I mean, they wouldn't talk about it, and they wouldn't tell anyone. No way.
Oh.
So it stems back from way back, where they just don't want to do that. But then when you're talking about some of these things, I mean, the psychological mess that sometimes happens to some of these individuals, I can understand why. Yeah. I mean, this all seems to be fitting into place.
Well, I think that one of the things that needs to happen, and because we're facing such large numbers, really, potentially, is I think we need to partner with the domestic violence community in a bigger way to make sure that this information gets out there. And I, for one, will commit. I'm on the board of Clackamas Women's Services, which is our domestic violence group off of shelter in Clackamas County. And I think one of my next civilian acts after I'm done here, I'd really like to see if we can have you give this presentation to that group. And I know I see Sybil in the audience, and I'm hopeful that she can help us. Also, if you can make a connection to thank you, Mr. Willis, actually, by the way, for being here today. Make a connection to get this education piece out to the rest of the folks who work on these issues, because the box that you described, you know, I don't think is as common knowledge as we would like it to be at this point in time as we face domestic violence issues. And we did pass a bill last go-round as well, the diversion bill, that if it is a veteran who admits that they have perpetrated domestic violence against, their spouse or whatever, that they can actually get diverted into a program. I believe it's at the discretion of the judge and the DA, but Mr. Taylor would probably be able to say a little more about that. But that was another piece of legislation that really feeds into this issue that we're dealing with. So, anyway, any other questions right now, colleagues, or comments? No? Anything else you'd like to add?
Just that I, on the veteran status, I would like to clarify that not only veteran status, but any military status.
Yeah.
As some Oregon National Guard reintegration team members have found out, you can spend 20 years in the National Guard, never deploy, and not qualify as a veteran, depending upon what service you're looking for or who you're talking to. Some areas you are, some areas you're not, and there's different definitions. Our recommendation is that any military service whatsoever should be identified at, or tracked. If you're arrested, have you had any military? And because those numbers aren't tracked. And if you want to work or collaborate with domestic violence community in the state, they're going to need access for that if you're going to come up with solutions for the military community. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being here today. I think this may give us further ideas for new folks to carry legislation forward. Let's go around.
We can try this again next week.
Okay. Now, next we have...
Madam Chair, I do apologize. I had to take off. I have another presentation I had to go give, but Madam Chair, I am at your disposal.
We'll be in touch for sure. I'm going to have some free time to pursue some of these issues in a different venue. So, and I'm not. I will not. I will say this on the record. I will not let this issue go. I don't need a title to do this work, and
thank
I don't think any
much.
Of us do. And I appreciate everything you've done. You've been fun to work with, great to work with, and I would like you to talk to our domestic violence folks in Clackamas County. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Elaine Lambert would like to address some issues as it relates to incarcerated veterans.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank we can you. Do that.
There's your presentation. Okay. I'm just trying to get it on the
record. I don't know what happened.
I don't know either, but I'm not worried about it.
Okay.
No, I guess it's more chances.
Well, I'm just in the flow right now. Good morning. It's nice to have you here today.
Should I introduce myself again?
Yes, that would be great for the record.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Colleen Louie, and I'm in the Department of Psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University. And I'm also live and reside in Clackamas County, so it's nice to have such a strong Clackamas presence today. I understand that I may have an overhead at some point, or not.
We have the documentation.
Excellent.
So we can
follow along. What I'm going to walk you through today is some very preliminary results from a study that we've been doing on military wives. And, again, this is very preliminary. We're actively collecting data, but I wanted to walk you through what we've been doing and what we're finding so far, because we're actually quite excited about how the study is proceeding. So on page 2, we have just kind of a little bit of a background. Military families are affected by military deployments. We have this great quote, when a soldier deploys, it's not just the soldier, the family deploys. The study is based on grants supplied from the National Institute of Mental Health. It's not a VA-funded study. So on page 3, this is kind of what we were thinking as we did this study. Does providing focused internet-based support identify and improve military family and indirectly warrior mental health? And what types of help are most useful? So where do we put the bang to get the best use of our buck? Page 4 is kind of some background in terms of what we already know. We know that both combatants and their families undergo extraordinary stressors, including separation, financial and emotional strain, as well as dangerous conditions for the combatants, and that many of these combatants come back with both psychological and physical challenges. Eddie did an excellent job of talking about how the military mindset really discourages people reaching out and seeking help. And the spouses who are left behind often don't know where or how to get help for their families. So on page 5, we talk about our program. This is a civilian-based research study. We've had a lot of help from people like Eddie and people at the VA. And it's had two stages. The first stage was to do in-depth interviews with a series of military wives. And they helped us create materials to make the website to reach out to a larger group. Page 6 has a piece of the study that we had in all of our flyers. And this is a requirement to put up a flyer at the VA. And it turned out to be a really important piece. Many of the military wives said that if they hadn't seen this on our flyer, that they would have been reluctant to talk to us. There is deep suspicion by many people of the VA. Confidentiality issues, they're being concerned that talking to outsiders is going to impact their husbands' careers. The interview results were telling. Wives reported, this is page 7, that post-deployment was more stressful than deployment itself. So even with all of the worries about, is my husband safe? The wife having to carry the load of, two parents, et cetera, post-deployment was more stressful, that reintegration piece. Wives reported that their husbands were very reluctant to seek help, particularly through the VA system. And oftentimes, the only reason that the husband sought out help was because the wife said, you are going to find help or I'm out. Wives, many of them reported feeling undervalued and under-supported through the military system. So what we did was we took the feedback from them and we created a website with a series of informational topics. Eddie wrote an excellent piece about a primer on military culture for those who aren't familiar with it. We talk about TBI, we talk about PTSD, we talk about what normal reintegration looks like. And we also asked the spouses to fill out a series of questionnaires assessing, describing what their family life is like. On page 9 is kind of a picture of what the website looks like. This is militarywivesmatter.org. And we thought that Rosie the Riveter was the perfect icon to describe the women that we're talking about. Strong, independent, they can do it all. They have Page 10, we launched our website as of May 24th, and as of Tuesday the 7th, we have 307 participants. These participants are about anywhere from 18 to 56 years old. The majority have children. We have 36 states represented, and we have 6 countries. These are all families that are deployed overseas. And the majority are Army. We have all branches represented but the Coast Guard. I don't know where they're hiding, but we haven't found them yet. We asked the wives to tell us what rank their husbands were. We have everyone from basic training up to a general's wife. Page 11, we asked them, how many times has your spouse deployed? 89% had spouses that had deployed at least once, but we had 5% that reported 6 or more deployments. These are families that their husbands are gone a lot. And that's since 2001. The enrollment options to be part of this study, we have them divided into groups. The first group is feelings of deep sadness for at least 2 weeks. And we call those our depressed spouse group. And the second is dealing with a spouse or partner who may be showing signs of PTSD. And again, this is the wife's perspective. Third group is to have both depression and a spouse with PTSD. And the last is the comparison group. We just added this. This is all the people that don't fall in the other category. And this would include male spouses. As was remarked earlier, the male spouses are an important group. And we started out the study just looking at female spouses, thinking that the information that we tailored toward female spouses wouldn't necessarily be the same information that would be pertinent to male spouses. We've opened it up to male spouses. We want them to look at the same stuff so we can get feedback as to how to improve it for them. And as of today, we have one. So we have not included him in the analyses so far because we don't want to kind of mess up the female results. So on page 13, we found that the majority of spouses live in urban areas and feel that they have adequate income. So that's enough money to get by to the end of the month. Nothing left over, but enough to get by. 34% are unemployed. 62% have family living more than 50 miles away. 24% live over 50 miles away from the nearest base. And 50% have husbands stationed over 50 miles away. So these are a lot of these ladies are isolated. And by the way, 15% say that they're barely getting by, struggling, or desperate.
I have a question for you.
Yes, sir.
You identified 34% are unemployed. Can you define that? Is that 34% are unemployed and want to be employed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So it's not the other word that
no, they're
taking care of.
They had other categories that included, you know, stay at home
right.
versus unemployed. There's another category for in school. Page 14, during the past 12 months, 55% felt that there was a time that they needed mental health treatment or counseling but didn't get it. What we found interesting was is if we broke those numbers down by the subject group, that the ones that said that they were doing okay, the control group, 25% of these ladies felt like they could have used some mental health treatment and didn't get it. And so we asked them, you know, why aren't you getting the mental health treatment? And there was a number of reasons that came out. Scheduling issues, childcare, couldn't afford it, was worried that it was going to hurt my husband's career, couldn't find a counselor who could understand the problems of a military family. They have unique needs. It's a unique culture, and you have to be able to speak the language. We also asked them, and again, this is just the wife's perspective, we asked them, how willing would you be to seek out mental health treatment, and how willing do you think your husband would be? And one of the questions that we asked them was, or asked them to either disagree or agree with, is, I would want to get psychological help if I was worried or upset for a long period of time. 84% of the spouses agreed with that. And then we said, what do you think your husbands would say? 54% would agree with that. That was their perspective on the husbands. So to me, that says that the wives are the key to getting in to help mm-hmm. these families. Wives are much more willing to seek out and get support for their families. So by gum, we got to figure out a way to use them. They could be our best resource in helping. We also gave them a screen for depression. And this is a very common screen, and it's not a diagnosis, but it is a commonly used screen. And a score of 26 and above is considered a cutoff for major depression. And interestingly, the traumatized warrior group, this is spouses of traumatized warriors, over 90% were depressed. Now, these were the ones that self-selected that they had a husband with PTSD, but not that they were depressed. So we found that extraordinarily interesting that they're not identifying depression within themselves. The other thing that came out is that the traumatized warrior group, and again, these are spouses who don't think that they're depressed, we're having a very hard time finding people for this group. The numbers are in the teens for this particular subgroup. And we finally realized that they're all going into the both group. The both group is huge, both meaning that they have depression and their husbands have PTSD. So finding spouses that think that their husbands have PTSD but they're not depressed is a very small group. And it's even smaller when you look at their depression scores. So one recommendation I would propose is that if there is a member of the family with PTSD, the spouse should be screened for depression.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Okay, depression. Some people are depressed, but it's not a clinical depression.
Correct.
Okay, so you're talking...
This is just a screen. We don't know for sure whether they would have a diagnosis of depression, okay. But the screen is indicative of further discussion. We also, on page 17, looked at a PTSD screen. This is just a screen. It's not a diagnosis. And this is the wife's perception of her husband's symptoms. But in my family, like many families, the wife usually knows. So, again, unsurprisingly, the traumatized warrior group had a huge percentage that would meet the cutoff score. But interestingly, in the depressed spouse group, this is depressed spouses who don't think their husbands have PTSD, 76% of those husbands met the cutoff.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Yeah.
What's TW? Okay.
Traumatized warrior.
What about now? You mentioned a number of women were unemployed, seeking employment.
Yes, sir.
What kind of assistance is there for veterans seeking employment? All things being equal, do they get a preference?
I think it depends. My understanding is that there's some incentive for businesses to hire veterans. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's some job placement assistance.
Well, if there's job, I think the whoever is in charge has to be proactive in finding employment for veterans.
Absolutely, but yeah. It doesn't include their wives necessarily. Does it?
I don't know. But well, okay. That I thought we were talking about women veterans who were unemployed, not wives.
No, we're just talking about the wives.
Wives of veterans.
Okay.
Wives of veterans.
Okay. Okay. Well.
So again, very preliminary study. We haven't finished collecting numbers. There's a number of limitations in this study in that we're asking the wives' perceptions about the veterans and the family. We're continuing to collect data. We had one participant email us and say that it seems like a good program so far. It's the first survey I've actually felt safe to answer honestly without it being held against me. And weirdly enough, it asked questions that I've been afraid to admit, questions I wouldn't have expected, but really hit the nail on the head. In the future, we'd like to target other groups like women veterans, male spouses, women veterans, parents of veterans, children of veterans, and basically at some point set up almost a virtual clinic, mental health clinic for veterans and their families. This family group is very important both for their own sake and for the health of the veterans. And I think by supporting the one, we're supporting all of them. I'd like to thank you for your time.
Yes. Any questions, colleagues, or comments? Yes, Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Obviously, it was funded by a grant, and the university did it.
Which will be up in another 6 months. Yeah.
You've set up, an internet base for the wives, and that's the direction. And as you just mentioned, funding doesn't come up for another 6 months. I would assume that first, the wives, under the wives program, there's some sort of confidentiality in there so that, for a better word, they're not trackable by the administration. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. We only collect email addresses on these women, and we have a certificate of confidentiality from the federal government, meaning that we have to protect this data. It is by law protected. So we can give out group information, but we can't give out individual information. And again, the only identifier we would have is email, and everyone can make up an email address.
Follow-up question.
Yes.
I guess my assumption is that some of the names, they're all doctors and PhDs and all that, trained psychologists is my assumption here, correct, for the most part?
In terms of who's running the study?
Check.
Yes, sir.
So follow up again.
Yes.
And you've set up one for the wives program. On the opposite side, could you just extrapolate and say how difficult would it be to set up for the other spousal units or the soldiers, whether they be male or female, a similar internet function with confidentiality outside of the administration?
That is our plan.
Mm-hmm. So you'd have one for the wives. And spouses, we'll say. That way, we'll say spouses.
Yeah.
And the other one for the service members. What are we talking in grant money and cost? The reason I'm driving to this question here is that we can spend $300 million, and we are not going to get those veterans to do anything with a live human being. But in the internet portion of it, and I'm not a psychologist, obviously. My wife says I'm insane. There is an opportunity here in which to at least address, to get people are going to be more willing, veterans are going to be more willing to go online in this century, even with WikiLeaks and everybody else out there, to use a service like this to try and get help from a third party that's at a distance than they are to do anything. Even if the National Guard were given money, which it won't be, or the Reserve is given money to do screening, and they're forced to do screening, they're going to lie through their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're not going to change the military culture, that diagram. And I think we're looking at the same exact problems we had in Vietnam. We're just now articulating them better, and we're not doing a bloody bit better today than we did back then. But I'm kind of looking for a cost. What's the size of the grant? What would it take to do a program like this?
That's a really good question. It's something that we've been talking about a lot up at OHSU. Part of our long-term plan with this virtual clinic is to enroll clinicians online to help reach out and give additional resources to families. So that's something that is underway. In terms of our own little piece, just our little bare-bones piece, we're just talking, $250,000 a year would keep us funded to continue doing what we're doing and doing more outreach and expanding our materials online.
Mm-hmm.
To add the counseling piece would be more expensive. But that is part of the under, that's where we're going.
But follow up.
Sure.
How, I would suspect that, and I don't know, maybe one of the committee members would know more than I do. I would assume that most PhD clinical psychologists say, "Oh no, no, we can't do that." But I mean, we got to get realistic here. They're not going to come to this. They're not going to go get medical treatment. And so, if this is better than nothing else, or this is the most effective way to reach them, I mean, how willing do you think clinical psychologists and their right professionals would be to provide it online?
I think it's the future of a lot of counseling, psychological counseling in general, and it's already being done. Telepsychiatry is one of the pieces in our department at OHSU that's being pushed right now. So that's already happening. And one of the reasons in particular we wanted to do an internet-based study is that when you've got people in the National Guard reserves, they're not connected in person. You know, they're not near a base. So these are people that are isolated. They don't have support from their communities of like people, because they are in the middle of nowhere. But most people nowadays can get to a computer and get to the internet. And what we're finding is we're on Facebook. This is the new, you know, this is a new century. So our Facebook page has over 1,600 friends as of May. From May to December, we have 1,600 friends. They're not all military spouses. Some of them are in the military themselves, but they all have some kind of connection to wanting to support the military. And they're all talking to each other. They're all supporting each other online. This is the future.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I'd like just to do a quick follow-up, too. So, it, to your knowledge, the work that you're doing now, are you one of the first in the country to really be looking at this? Is there something going on any other places that you're connecting with at this level of...
There are other people doing military family research, can't, of course, blocking her name, but in the southwest, I'm going to say Utah, but I'm not sure. There's a big group of people doing work on military families. I think we're one of the few that are looking more toward the internet.
Okay. But if you could get those resources to us, I mean, I would like to find out where I'd get some, you know, actual professional, you know, published papers, those kinds of things.
Well, there's certainly a lot of in-person interviews with wives and family members, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Colleagues, any additional questions or comments? Well, thank you so much for coming today. I think what you're doing is actually groundbreaking again and essential with what we need to move forward. And I know, colleagues, next session is going to be very, very difficult for the two of you that will be back in terms of dollars. I imagine this program is going to have to stay grant-funded, but I want to appreciate Senator Boquist and your willingness to at least get to the root of this and maybe see this as a way to really get people the help they need. And I don't know where we can help you with funding or however, but I think it's an excellent program. Thank you for the
Thank
work
you
that
so
you're
much.
Doing. Okay. All right. Well, we are going to stick to the agenda, colleagues. I do have a request from Elon Lambert to come up and speak a little bit about veterans in the criminal justice system. If the folks here for the USS Ranger Foundation would be patient, why don't we move ahead with Elon first, and then we will finish up with you folks. So
we will have to take a brief break.
All right. Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I just wanted to, as I was listening to Eddie Black speak, what I've been doing is, with the Partnership for Veterans at Risk, is working with veterans who are involved in the criminal justice system. And when you were asking about if anybody is keeping any statistics, I know that Marion County Jail, for an example, is now asking if people have military service when they are going to the intake, as is Multnomah. And so there are different counties that are keeping those numbers. I have worked since May with about 60 veterans now who are involved in the criminal justice system. And when we're talking about with the cadre program and the domestic violence and the substance abuse, almost, I would say, 95% of the veterans that I'm working with are substance abuse is definitely involved, and there's a high rate of domestic violence that cases that are happening. And one of the things that I have found with the veterans that I'm working with is that when they are involved, whether it's domestic violence or just violence acts, that what they automatically happens to them is they go back. What they tell me is the rules of engagement engage for them, and they are doing what it is that they are taught to do. So when they were showing the soldier's box, that's exactly what it is that happens. But the rate of people who are getting involved in the criminal justice system is just skyrocketing, and it's something that I think that we all need to be very aware of, because we are having so many vets, and I've working with some. I've got a couple of Vietnam vets I'm working with, one from Bosnia, who had a lot of difficulty in PTSD from there, but a lot of them are the Iraq, Afghanistan vets, and a number of them are. It seems like the higher the number of deployments, the more the risk is for them to be involved in the criminal justice system. I've been working with Judge Ochoa here in Marion County, and we've written a curriculum to teach the judges in the state on veterans issues. We've also held orientation type of training for the public defenders, the criminal lawyers, and the DAs here in Marion County to give them information about a lot of what Eddie Block was talking about in the veterans issues. So that's something we're trying to do around the state. We've also got veterans that are involved in taking medications for sleep, like Ambien, and what happens when you connect Ambien with alcohol is I'm working with three vets who have found themselves, thought they were going to sleep, who ended up waking up in a jail cell because it can give you a blackout and you are actively involved, but you have no memory of what happens with that. And one of them is very, very serious crimes. So it's happening, but I just wanted to let you know that there are places like the jails that are keeping track of the veterans that are coming in. And what happens with Marion County Jail is the mental health worker, Gary Cohen, gets the names, and then he calls me, and I get the, whether it's the reintegration team, Linda Maddie from the Veteran Justice Outreach Specialist from the Portland VA Hospital involved, and we're being able to get a lot of veterans treatment rather than jail. So there are things that are happening.
Are you talking about a diversion program then?
Some of them are diversion, but I can tell you, for an example, Judge Ochoa is very supportive of veterans. In fact, he hands out my flyer from the bench, and he also has set over hearings to make sure that the vets can get to me to make sure that they can get help. So some of it is diversion, some of it's not. It's just seeing what can be given to them. And the Senate Bill 999 has come into effect in a number of cases, although I can tell you there's still a lot of attorneys that don't know about Senate Bill 999.
What would be a suggestion to get the word out? I mean, because I hear you're working very closely with Marion County. It would be nice to have you connect to, obviously, I'm biased to Clackamas County. You know, what's the suggestion to get the word out a little bit more? I know you can't clone yourself.
No, but I'm actually involved in some things in Multnomah County. I'm going to be doing a piece of the teaching for the recruits for the police department, and we're setting up trainings around the state. We're going to do the veterans at risk trainings again, but we are going to do trainings around the state for judges, but also for the DAs and the lawyers.
Okay. Yeah. Well, please keep us in the loop with this one. I suspect I know some folks from my neck of the woods that would be very, very interested in the opportunity for the education. So.
Right, and I have been up to the Clackamas County Jail to visit veterans up there, but it's just letting people know that the services are available. And it's also been a very big help to the families, because one of the things that I do with the family members is educate them about the idea that the soldier that you sent, that deployed, is never going to come back. Everybody's changed. And I've had to tell families, families. If you need to grieve that, you need to do that, because as long as you continue to hold the idea that your soldier that went away is the person that should come back, you're alienating the soldier, and you're also not giving them the support that they need. So there are some good resources for people to read and to look at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Any additional questions? No? Thank you,
Elena.
It's great to see you today, and thank you so much for coming. This has been a great way to end this part of my life. Mr. Taylor, now you suggested we take a short break.
I think we need to take a short break so we can get the technical people in here to work on the computer and as it relates to the screen. So our next witnesses, they have a PowerPoint presentation, and they can't make it unless we...
So what we will do is, do we have any idea how long that will take? I mean, recess... I think about 5 minutes. All right. So, colleagues, let's take a brief recess for 5 minutes, and we'll come in and check back in and get the last PowerPoint done. So let's recess and... reconvene and finish up our agenda, the Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs. Let's bring us out of recess and into committee. And I'd like to welcome up folks from the USS Ranger Foundation, Captain Peter Ogle, United States Navy, retired, and then Lonnie Dykus, who's a senior foundation advisor. So if you gentlemen would step forward and, for the record, tell us who you are with an introduction, and we'll get started.
Okay. Thank you very much for inviting us to be here today. We certainly appreciate what you do for our veterans, and at any rate, I'd like to get on with the presentation. Just a little bit of background. I'm a retired naval aviator, served on aircraft carriers, light attack aviation, strike fighter is in the term they use today for the things that we did in the past. But it's an exciting thing. Lonnie, if you want to give a little bit about your background, go right ahead.
Senators, thank you again for having us here. My name is Lonnie Dykus. I'm a senior advisor to the foundation. I've been involved with real estate development projects and economic development for the past 20 years, and I've been working with the Ranger Foundation for approximately the last 6 months.
That takes care of the first slide. I'd like to talk a little bit about the overview of their program. Our mission statement, we'll discuss that. Chinook Landing Marine Park, which you all know is our chosen place to go, which is a fantastic location for Ranger.
And I just, Madam Chair, I just want you to know that Chinook Landing Marine Park is in my district.
Okay, I know.
And I know, too.
I'm glad it is.
I'll give a little discussion on the Navy application process, which is a very difficult program to get through. I'll talk about ship location, relocation, and the project cost and our master schedule. Essentially, we're dedicated to preserve the USS Ranger as a community heritage center through public and private partnerships. And what that means, it's that the carrier itself is just like the carrier when it's in service. It provides many missions. They range from diplomacy to humanitarian assistance, rescue of people on the high seas, show of force, and when it escalates beyond the show of force, the ability to use force against our enemies that would do harm to the United States of America. We will have private partnerships with us. This is important that we meld into the community. We don't want to be there just as a warship, but more of a site that has many uses. And it's particular as a place for veterans to use and have ceremonies, have meeting space aboard the ship, and that sort of thing. As opposed to just a memorial where they can look at something on a wall or a plaque or something, but it's a place where they can have their activities. Our other partners really in this would be the business community. It would be the associations and those organizations such as the hotel industry, tourism, and that sort of thing. So we have a wide spectrum of relationships that we can have across the broad spectrum of the community.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Seems to me there was some discussion about some ships docked in the Portland area as not only for what you're talking about, but in case of emergency when the big 9.2 hits off the Oregon coast and
yes.
Bridges fall down in Portland and half of the buildings are gone and so on, that there be, is that part of this whole thing?
Certainly it is. Emergency preparedness, we could have emergency preparedness aboard the ship that the ship floating in the Columbia River is essentially immune from the devastation of an earthquake. It would survive it. And we have a 60-bed hospital aboard. Mm-hmm. And that can be activated, and it can be activated for use for training, to have it pre-stocked with medical supplies, to have our storerooms full of blankets, meals ready to eat, cots to go ahead and put people in the hangar deck and triage, and also a helicopter landing place and the communications where you can get to the outside world. So, yes, it's a very big, important part. Chinook Landing is an excellent site. It is a existing park. Metro gave us a letter of intent on the 6th of August that we accepted to use their property for mooring the USS Ranger. The site itself, I'll get to that in the next slide to talk about the development, but we'll be involved with the evaluation of the site conditions as well. And this is, I'm talking about environmental aspects of it.
And Madam Chair, yes. If you notice, the lake up there is Blue Lake, right.
Mm-hmm.
And Blue Lake Park, if any of you need to sort of know. I was a lifeguard there for a while.
Last year, you said.
Yeah, last year.
And that is the Columbia River in the foreground. Here is another look at it. The Chinook Landing area. You can see the infrastructure, that's Marine Drive. We will probably have some satellite parking because we don't want to interfere with the use of Chinook Landing for what it was originally done as a boat landing operation. And, of course, during salmon season, that parking lot is full of trucks and trailers. And, of course, the river is full of salmon fishermen. But it is an excellent place to be. We're not in an industrial area like we would have been in the city of Portland. It's a family-friendly atmosphere, and it has easy access. We've come up with a couple of conceptual drawings. This is going to be in our new brochure, which we're bringing up to date for our marketing and that sort of thing. The top one just shows it at Chinook Landing. It's an artist rendering. And the bottom one to the right is showing what the hangar bay it looks like. It is huge. It's 25 feet high. It's 750 feet long. You can have about 5,000 of your best friends in there at any given time.
Madam, I'm sorry. One other question. Is this currently in Oakland docked right now?
Pardon?
Is this the carrier that's in Oakland, California?
No, that's the USS Hornet. That's is not the.
So where is this carrier?
This carrier is in Bremerton, Washington.
Oh, Bremerton.
It's still in the custody of the Navy. The one in Oakland is Alameda. Is a Hornet, and that is a museum ship. It has been turned over as a donation to the people that operate.
I did see that ship.
A little bit about the Navy application process. When I came on board the foundation, it was just a few days after that they changed the whole application process and put us on a 60-day schedule to get phase one in, which we did, and that was accepted in September 2. Phase two, we just got an extension on our application for that, and the new extension date will be July 31st, 2012. That's a typo on the slide. And then once we get through that and that's evaluated, we go into phase three, which will be completed by March 31st, 2013. And these are all new figures. These just came out in our recent discussions with the Navy. And the completion of the donation, not later to date, it will be July 31st, 2014. The Navy wants the ship removed from their custody at that time because they have other uses for those docks up in Bremerton. And it'll either go to us or it'll be taken to a salvage yard and cut up for scrap. and we want the former to happen, and it's to the benefit of both Oregon and Washington State. Oops, hit the wrong thing again. Here's just the statistics on the Ranger, just a little bit. Commissioned in 1957, I think you probably all know this. It is a huge ship, 1,000 feet in length, draft 37 feet in, as it sits in the ocean with a full air wing aboard. And it goes through the ocean at some 34 knots and has 5,500 people living aboard it. It's a floating city. This is the PSA video, which is not going to be operable today, unfortunately. It's a 60-second video that was produced and it was shown at the Blazers game with Toronto back in November. It was a great, great video, and it shows the ship at sea. And what's most important about this, and the point I wanted to make on it, it shows people. It's not just a vessel sitting there, you know, a cold hunk of big iron, but it's the people that make it. And these people, there was a picture, there was one of the pictures in the video that shows the hangar bag with a whole, is packed full of the crew, and their different colored jerseys that they wear aboard the ship. These are the future veterans, and these are the people that the Veterans Affairs Department of Oregon will be concerned with and so forth once they get out of naval service.
Madam Chair, will there be some, with the Portland Air Base right there, will there ever be some demonstration flights from the deck of the carrier?
No. The carrier would not be capable of either launching or recovering aircraft or that sort of thing. But there will be static aircraft on the flight deck for people to view.
Okay.
There would be... helicopter operations would be available on the forward part of the flight deck, as I mentioned, in the emergency preparedness and bringing people in for triage or transporting people that have been triaged back to a medical center away from the epicenter of an earthquake or floods or whatever a natural disaster may hit. So it can be a center for that sort of thing, and that would be the extent of the air operations.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
How could I get a hold of the Ranger PSA?
I can get you a copy.
You send me a
I
copy
certainly will.
Electronically?
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And is it permissible to put it on my website if I wanted to do that?
It is on our Ranger website.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
You
can go on the Ranger website, go to Ranger Videos, and click on that. And it's really great. It's a fast-moving, it's sort of a flash video that goes from one scene to the other, you know, from the cook in the galley to someone serving meals to the operating room. It shows every facet in about 60 seconds of what happens aboard the ship. And this was done not just for Ranger, but for all the military services. That was Military Appreciation Night at the Blazers game that this was introduced. And we'll use it in our marketing quite a bit.
That's the website number for the foundation?
Yes.
That's what you're talking
yes.
about?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and turn this over now to Lonnie, if you want to go ahead and pick up on the ship relocation, the environmental permitting, transportation, and site development.
That's great, Peter. Thank you. You know, you were talking about the website just real briefly. One of the things that's happened to the organization, the Ranger organization, is, and I like to say this when I get in front of a group of people, is that, you know, there has been tremendous progress made within our organization in the last 4 to 5 months. I think in some ways we've made more progress just internally in the last 4 or 5 months than possibly the last 4 or 5 years. And one of those things is we've brought on board a communication manager, and you'll find that we have a very up-to-date site. We post a lot of information on that site. There's a lot of links on that site. We're on on Twitter and a lot of other social media that folks can connect to us. So that is a great way for certainly you folks, anybody else that's watching this, or certainly anyone who gets when it gets connected with the organization. It's a great way to see it because we post videos there, we post pictures, we try and give status on where we are with our Navy application and that kind of thing. So that's just a great piece the folks can go to get information about what's current, what's happening with us. So I want to make sure we were clear about that.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Is there a place to donate also online?
Yes, absolutely. You're so kind to ask. Okay. So kind.
There's a big button there that says donate now. All right. And you can donate on, you know, through PayPal or credit card online.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that's great. But I want to make sure and get that piece out.
While we're talking about donations, just for your tracking purposes on the radar screen, the implementation bills that are going through Environment and Natural Resources in the beginning of January or February, March of this session, there's a Parks implementation bill and a OWEB implementation bill. And both of those have modifications that allow non-governmental entities now and persons to apply for grants related to parks. And I would envision both those bills are going to go through in some portion or the other. So, well, that's not obviously a full funding source, but it is an opportunity since this is an existing park that there may be facets of your 2014 plan that would now qualify, at least under the draft legislation reviewed in Environmental and Natural Resources yesterday, where, as example, at this park, you may be able to get, you know, a partial grant for parking areas or something like that. It's all grant process, but it is a change from the present law.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And based on the last 76 mm-hmm. passage. Before, it was government only, and now it's going to be non-governmental entities and persons.
One aspect of our application process, I'd assign a letter that we would not accept funds from the federal government. And this really relates just to the ship itself. That doesn't mean we couldn't accept funds either from the federal government. Say if Metro, which is their property, they're a landlord, wanted to expand the parking lot.
This is
that would be okay.
These are lottery funds,
mm-hmm.
state lottery funds.
Okay. But I'm just saying that we couldn't expect federal funds to help us with the ship.
No.
We get the ship as is, where is, and that's it.
I wanted to ask a clarifying question.
Yes.
And actually, Senator.
Yes, Senator.
With this legislation, is it? May I ask who sponsored it, or is
it's the implementation. 76.
Oh, it's a measure. I'm sorry.
Measure 76 passed requires the legislature to go back and make changes in the statutes.
In our last election.
Right. Okay.
The measure 66, which, you know, has parks grant money and so on and so forth like that. And I guess in the measure it says that, you know, one of the deals is there...
It can go out to engineers.
Right, because it's all previously been government entities. And now it actually literally said, must say persons and non-governmental entities and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Sorry, I do...
Just an opportunity.
I think that is a great idea, and thanks for bringing that up. Okay.
Anything
that's
great.
Yeah.
Thanks so much
that's
for that. I really appreciate it. And, you know, that's one of the things that's so important. Peter just touched on it. You know, one of the things that we've had just tremendous success with this project, and we picked up so much momentum, you know, on the project in the last, you know, many months, is that that very much we have redrafted and recrafted the mission statement to really be a community project. And it's so important to say that over and over. You know, we go out and we talk with folks about being the Fairview community or Wood Village or Troutdale or Gresham or the other communities we're involved with. You know, when we're lucky enough to go out and talk to those folks, you know, it's very important. We make a big deal about, we sit down and talk with them about, this is as much about our listing about what you want and what you want this project to be as much as we're talking about what we're trying to do and trying to accomplish. So I think that we've had just tremendous success with that, about trying to connect with our local communities, our regional communities, our regional governments, and those folks to really hear what they want to see in the project, because this is very much a community-based project. But let's get back to our slide here. We're talking about the relocation piece, and Right now, there's so many pieces to this project, and you kind of, you know, it's not where it's something you can take sequentially. You can kind of do piece by piece. We have to move on multiple fronts at once, and so certainly the pieces that we're doing right now, we're certainly moving forward on doing the environmental analysis. We got a grant to help us with that environmental work, so we're doing the first stages of doing the environmental site analysis there at Chinook Landing Marine Park and looking at the site conditions. And I would tell you that just based on some very preliminary information that we've gathered, that it looks like it's going to be a great site for us to use. It looks like it can accommodate what we're trying to accomplish. So at least at this early stage, we're not, you know, don't anticipate any significant problems, at least with the soils and site conditions there. So that's great news. We're also starting to move forward, or we will shortly, on the permitting process. And that's certainly working with all the, you know, the city there at Fairview and the surrounding cities, and certainly the county and state and other folks that we need to work with. We know we're going to have to work with the, you know, the Marine Fisheries Group and all those groups, so we're trying to coordinate that. And I would just tell you that we've had great success. The city of Fairview has really been a wonderful partner for us, and they've been able to bring in Oregon Solutions to start to work with us, and hopefully we can get Oregon Solutions to take this on as one of their sponsored projects and move forward on that basis. So again, we've had just great success in working with a lot of the partners that Peter's talked about, governmental and certainly non-governmental. On transportation issues, that's not going to be a small challenge for us, certainly, to bring it up to the Columbia River and get it through the various bridges we have to, and railroad bridges and those kinds of things. And we certainly have started those conversations, and that's going to be a logistical issue that we have to work through. I think, Peter, I don't know if you want to say a few words about some of those conversations.
Yes. We have met with Emirates International, who is a mega mover and so forth. Mm-hmm. But we know it's doable to get through the bridges, but is it politically and financially going? That is going to be the big thing, and we're going to need a great deal of support from the government, from the state, probably both Washington and Oregon, and even nationally on this. But this is it's going to be a major effort to make this happen without knocking down a bridge. We certainly don't want to put
we might finally get our crossing.
But there's some innovative ideas on how to do this. We are talking to Terry Emmerich. We could be winched through rather than pushed through by tugboats, because you'd have better control with that. It's like, you know, moving a house on land, but here we're on in a fluid, and we want to make sure that that thing doesn't move one inch or too far in one direction and touch the bridge. So those things are technical challenges, but they're doable, and I believe we can make this happen, and it'll be a real event when that occurs. I'm sure the Discovery Channel will be there, and there'll be a lot of good publicity come about what American ingenuity can do in tackling a big project.
I know Terry Emmerich.
Yes,
yes,
he's a great guy.
Very ingenious. Yes,
yes. He can get things done.
Uh-huh. The last item I want to touch on was site development, and certainly that's part of the process that we're starting to look at now, and we're looking at the environmental conditions, as I mentioned earlier, but eventually we need to go into what kind of site development, and that is looking at the infrastructure, be that roads, water, sewer, those kind of things that certainly that we'll need. And that's something, obviously, we're going to work with, the city of Fairview and the county and other folks to try and coordinate that process. So those are just some of the ship relocation issues. We now go to, and I don't know why Peter always likes to have me talk about this particular slide, but that's all right. That's all right.
I don't want to say I said it.
That's exact. No, I think the project costs that we've done is we've looked at other ships in making an estimate of these project costs, their preliminary costs. As I said, we've looked at other ships, and this is the cost we include in our application. As we move farther through this process, we get good estimates, engineering and other estimates that we'll need to determine what these various costs are, be that the permitting side, the site development, relocation and repair and recondition of the ship, that we'll have a better handle on those. But this is certainly the order of magnitude that we've been looking at so far, and certainly when we have more information, we'll make it available. But this is where we are at this stage, this early stage of the project. Okay. Now, the master schedule about putting the project and bringing the ship here, As Peter's talked about, we got our site approval or the letter of intent we had with Metro on August 6th. We expect that in order to complete the entire Navy donation process, that'll be a three-phase process. We believe that we'll need all up through July of 2014. That is a very thorough process, to say the least. Peter and I and a bunch of other folks were involved with putting the Phase 2 application together. That was a three-inch document that just they left no stone unturned about wanting to know how this process would go, how the foundation would come together, and the process we went through in terms of, you know, evaluating the site and how we're going to get the ship here and the financials and really the market justification for supporting this project. And that's certainly something we haven't touched on here today, but one of the other pieces that we've recently completed in the last 4 to 5 months is we undertook a significant a market feasibility analysis of the site and of the project to in order to determine this was, in fact, a feasible project that we could go forward. And we got that determination. That was included in our Navy application. And it's something, certainly, Peter, we probably want to mention a little bit later in the presentation about the relative economic and other impact this project will have on the entire region. Getting back to our master schedule, you can see that, as we said, the Navy donation process, we do see that taking up through 2014.
I have a suggestion. Okay,
so, yeah.
Earmarks are not dead.
God bless you, Senator.
Well, we don't have state earmarks, but I'm sure Merkley and whoever the other guy is can figure it out. Yeah, no, seriously, if yes. Mark Hatfield were here, he would make sure it happened.
Oh.
And earmarks are simply giving some of the money back to the states that they send to Washington, and we don't get as much back as other states have that have defense places. So I think the federal funding for site development should be a valid thing. So I hope they're working on that.
The restriction for Ranger getting the money for Ranger itself really is Navy driven, because what's happened in the past, when a museum ship gets in trouble, they go to their congressional caucus and they ask for money in the form of earmarks to fix the ship from sinking.
Well, no, we're talking about site development.
Right, but the reason for that is that the Navy does not want to come out of their budget. That is the whole thing. But it can come out of someone else's budget if it's for doing infrastructure.
Right.
The other things I would say about the master schedule, you can see there's an approximate time of 9 months to do the ship. That's to do the necessary repairs to the ship and get it in the kind of condition. You know, one of the things we're so lucky with is that the Ranger, when it was decommissioned, was anticipated to be, was immediately put up for ship donation. So it has been preserved in remarkable condition. So we do not anticipate, while it would be a large effort, that it not will not be certainly an overwhelming effort. And the hull and the basic superstructure, and said the conditions of the ship itself are really quite in remarkable shape. We talked a little bit about site development, and we anticipate that when you get through the permitting process and everything else, that would probably take something like 12 months, and so you see a project opening in the fall of 2015. You know, Senator, I just want to comment on one thing you said. You know, it's about emergency preparedness. One of the things we haven't touched on here real briefly is, you know, when you look at this ship, we've tried to keep a very structured presentation here, but it is very easy to get very excited about what we're trying to do, because there's so many different facets to this project that resonate with the community. We spent so much time to try and make sure we connected to our community, but when you look at the possibilities and the potentiality of the project, it's really something quite special, because, you know, you talked about emergency preparedness, which I think is very, very significant, Senator. I think just the fact that, you know, it's so obvious about having a museum and memorial there, you know, something that it's always fun to talk about when we talked about the renderings we had. This will be the largest floating museum in the world. This is not a small thing, and it's not a small thing just in terms of physical size, but certainly in size of the concept. And you look at the kind of vocational, educational, you know, possibilities with a ship, they really are quite tremendous. I think the other thing is, you know, I did want to talk about real briefly, and that is the economic impact of a project like this. The market and feasibility study that we've had and had others look at and comment on us, we're anticipating to have approximately 300,000 visitors per year to this project. That's a lot. We look at the potential impact, both direct and indirect jobs in the region from this project, is in excess of 500 jobs. When we look at the regional economic impact, it's in excess of $45 million for this project. So it is significant. It is significant for the community. It is significant for the region. It is significant for the state. So it is. It's been a wonderful project to be involved with. It has been, I would say, all my 20, 25 years of development experience, I've never seen a project so embraced by the community. East County loves this project. They have been so happy and so gracious to us and welcomed us in so many ways. So it's really been a lot of fun. Peter, perhaps you want to end on this for us?
Sure. I might add, though, of course, Portland, City of Portland and the City of Vancouver both have given us supportive resolutions from councils. Is this the end? No, it's an incredible opportunity for this whole area. This is something no one else will have. If we look here at the four aircraft carrier, four Forrestal aircraft carriers, Ranger is on the right. It's the one that's the cleanest looking. It's been there actually the longest of all the other carriers that are there, but that's because it was mothballed. It's in excellent condition. This will be a one-time opportunity. What you're looking at here is one half of the Navy aircraft carriers that were built since World War II with a conventional power plant. All the rest of the carriers are nuclear now. Our entire fleet of nuclear carriers are nuclear powered. None of those ships will ever become a museum ship for obvious reasons. It's against Navy policy. They will be, when Enterprise goes out in 2014, she'll be taken to Newport News. Her reactor will be removed of all the nuclear fuel rods. She'll be towed around to Bremerton, and she'll be cut up to take out the residual parts of the nuclear power system. So she will never become a museum ship. So this is a one-time opportunity for the state of Oregon and Washington to have in their midst the supercarrier for the future, because the deck size, the flight deck, the hull form is similar to the nuclear power carriers. So we'll be a representative ship, and that's a one-time opportunity for it to put us on the map. And after all, Portland is a port city. I mean, we're a seafaring nation, and it's the United States Navy who goes over the horizon and makes the commerce and trade among nations work, and that's essential to our economy. So on that note, I will end this, and thank you very much for inviting us up here today, Senators.
Yes, Senator.
I had the opportunity to be in San Diego a couple of weeks ago, and I went down to the harbor and I saw the USS Midway, and I mean, it was mammoth. Mm-hmm. How does that size, that one, compare to this one?
Okay, I can answer that. The Midway was designed and built in World War II mainly to be a stronger ship against the Japanese kamikaze attacks. They never saw action in World War II. They were straight deck carriers. The super carrier came in because of the jet age. They needed a larger carrier than Midway to handle heavy aircraft, jet aircraft, and that sort of thing. And actually, in the construction of the first two Forrestal carriers, they were being built with straight decks because they hadn't really thought about the concept when they were doing the design work that, hey, we have to put an angle on this to make it safe for jet aircraft to operate. Ranger was the first carrier. She was number three of the Forrestal class that was, from the keel up, built with the the angled deck. The others were modified during construction for the angled deck. So it represents a real change. In size, Midway's, I can give you some examples. Midway's hangar bay is 17 feet high from floor to ceiling. Rangers is 25, okay. And that's to handle these bigger aircraft. It has just a much greater capacity. It has an extra deck level. There's Midway has two decks above the hangar's deck ceiling of space for staterooms and what have you. But Ranger has three, so it has one whole deck larger. So it's larger in every respect. And that is really the same size is equal to what your nuclear carriers are today. They have more capability and so forth. They can carry, they do not have to carry oil to burn for propulsion and that sort of thing. So they can carry more fuel for aircraft. But that's the whole purpose of it.
You're going to have to come back, Madam Chair. They will have to come back because I dropped it's SCR1. I already dropped it.
Actually,
I dropped a resolution. I think Bill gave you a copy of it.
Yes.
It's not public yet until January when they first meeting. Yeah.
Well, Senator, we really appreciate getting a resolution. That would be tremendous. I mean, that means that's big time for us. That was very important. We appreciate your efforts on that.
Good luck with this. I think it's a wonderful idea. I've also been on the Midway. It's just to see that this is bigger than a Midway, which I thought was pretty big when I was there. Good luck with this, and thank you for ending. Again, are there any other questions or comments?
Well, one other question. Have you really talked to our entire congressional delegation about...
Not since I've been aboard. I've been just I'm the newcomer.
Okay.
I've been 18 months now since getting involved in the project.
All the criteria that you have fits perfectly with federal dollars for support.
That's great.
Not on the carrier itself, but with the site development and all
That'd
of
be
that
great.
Other stuff. It's a natural for it.
We do have a letter of support from Senator Merkley. He sent that direct to the Navy, bypassed us, but it was a strong letter of support.
Good.
But I have the copy of it. But, yes, he's a supporter.
Okay. Well, don't forget the earmarks.
All right. I'm the earmarks.
Earmarks, okay.
Thank you very much for being here today. I appreciate your coming. I think, Senator Mona Sanderson, this is going to be a great opportunity for your district, and I'll get online and donate today. How's that? I don't know if we can urge people to do that publicly, but why not? Right.
But we do bring, that is one of our main, we send a blast out on the Internet, and we all of a sudden, we have all these PayPal things coming
people,
into us.
Yeah,
yes, it works.
It works.
And, our Facebook, we're up to 2,600 now, friends on Facebook. So we're using all the modern stuff
to do it.
New technology, and which is a little beyond me sometimes. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming today. Well, colleagues, it looks like we're going to get out of here even before 11 o'clock. I don't know. Mr. Willis, I know, would love to step forward. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will be brief. I want to do a postscript on the Ranger presentation and tell you that I've never seen a project since I've been around Oregon Veterans for very close to 40 years now, where all branches of the service have joined together that are veterans to support the project.
It's a miracle.
And the reason I know that is because I worked the Ranger booth at the boat show at Portland about 2 years ago. And three Navy veterans were at the boat show working the booth, and everybody else was from a different branch of the service. So that shows sort of a connectivity in how great this project is for our state. The second thing I'd like you to know is that I did a presentation on the Ranger project at La Pine at the American Legion Post. And I just asked out of curiosity, it was a last-minute question, is there anybody in the audience today who served on the USS Ranger? And two hands went up.
They served at two different eras, and of course, when the meeting was over, these two fellows were able to connect with each other. But it occurred to me that if you're commissioned in 1957 and you have a crew of over 5,000 people and you were in service that long, you're talking about a lot of people who served on the Ranger. But to find two of them in Lapine, Oregon, at an American Legion convention,
didn't even know
was
each other.
Unbelievable.
Did they buy or did you buy?
Madam Chair, I was actually campaigning, door knocking, and for some reason we started talking about the Ranger, and I don't know how it came up. He says, the Ranger is going to come here. I served on the USS Ranger.
There you go. This was
when I was campaigning. So, yeah.
Well, and the last thing is a bit of history, and I hope the captain will forgive me if I get this wrong, but I think I'm pretty close. There's been a Ranger in the United States Navy inventory since the Revolutionary War. And I believe this one was the eighth ship to be named Ranger. So there's a history that needs to be preserved here. And I hope that the people of Oregon will continue to support this great project.
That is a really interesting piece of information.
Madam Chair, I may be wrong about this. If I remember correctly, in my history, the first Ranger was the captain was John Paul Jones, if I were correct.
Yeah. Wow.
Fairly well known in Navy circles.
Yeah. Yes. And in the Revolutionary War.
Right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing
thank
me this moment.
Thank you for coming and speaking
today.
We're
going to have to dress up like him then.
Yeah. Okay. So
Madam Chair, we would be remiss if we didn't say some fond words about you as chair.
Please don't make me do something.
I won't make you cry. I feel so honored to have served with you. You have such a passion. I was just thrilled when you took over the Veterans Committee, and obviously under your watch, so much has been done. I'm going to miss you tremendously, but I do want you to know that you have done so much for the state of Oregon in just the very short time that you have been here. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much, Martha.
Well,
you've been wonderful.
I appreciate it. I was hoping I would get through the meeting without going there,
no,
but
no chance.
I had to say something. Oh, my gosh. Thank you for that, Senator. Appreciate it.
And when we gavel out, we have some other comments for you, too.
Oh, good God.
So, we won't embarrass you. We'll let the tape goes off and the gavel goes out. So.
General Caldwell, do you want to...
We're gonna go ahead.
Should we gavel out?
We'll go ahead and gavel out first.
Okay. Why don't we? Okay. So long. It's been good to know you. but I will be back, I'm sure, in one capacity or another, continuing to work on these issues. And particularly, I think I've talked to Tom, talked to Mr. Willis and General Caldwell, and my colleagues. I do think there's going to be some opportunities if you guys give me guidance from here at the federal level. I'm finding out that the spouses in D.C. of congressmen actually have some cachet, which is kind of fun.
Earmarks.
And earmarks. Yeah, there you go. Earmarks.
Well, you got to find a different term, okay?
Earmarks. Okay. Earmarks.
Right. Job creation.
But we will. I will keep active in these issues, and I think really with Tom's help and all your help, there's going to be some opportunities at that level to keep this front and center. And I also want to thank you, colleagues, for your continued support. All of you have been wonderful to work with, and wish I was back, but on to bigger and better adventures at this point. And thank you for, if you don't mind me sharing this with Voices of the Guard, there was a kind of an offline conversation that I'd like to get on the record.
There's no quorum.
But of actually taking some of the Guard's words that Francis Ritchie has pulled together in next session, reading, two a week. And I would like to get that on the record because I'd like the Guard to know that that the words of the Guard are really going to keep us front and center with what we need to do for our troops. So enough talking with that. Let's gavel out. And take care, everyone.
Yeah, you can't